These places. Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue Wednesday, February 12th. And happy birthday to someone who knows who I'm saying happy birthday to. At the beginning, that if anyone is here for a work session on House Bill 4009, that was for the purpose only to discuss amendments, not to take action. I don't intend to do a work session on that today. We don't have any new information since we just met last night. I'm opening an informational meeting on the revenue forecast. Mr. Elmanac.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is the quarterly forecast update with Mark McBallin and Josh Lehner from the Office of Economic Analysis. So this is the update since the December forecast.
Great. And welcome to our Senate colleagues who join us.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. I'm Mark McMullen, the Oregon State Economist, joined as always by my colleague, Joshua Lehner. As Chris mentioned, to go ahead and give the quarterly update on the economic and revenue forecast. So the last time we met in front of this group, we spent our time really delving into the risk of recession, because at that time it was very highly elevated, as it's still elevated today, but we've seen fears among forecasters fall off a little bit in the interim. So here you see the same chart I showed last time, which shows the Wall Street Journal survey of professional forecasters, and it asks folks like ourselves what is the likelihood of a recession happening in the next year. And last time we met, it was about as elevated as it ever gets, at around a 1 in 3 chance. And now you see it has slacked off or lightened up since, where now the typical forecaster is saying about a 1 in 4 chance of recession over the next year. And that's because at the time, there were two real main primary concerns that forecasters had. The first was the trade war and a lot of uncertainty surrounding that. And a lot of that uncertainty, there's been a little bit of a back off in terms of the hostilities there, and a lot of at least that uncertainty about which goods would be targeted and how far it would go has cleared up a little bit. And that's helped people allay their fears a little bit. And there are also at the time there are issues in lending markets with interest rates and an inverted yield curve at the time, which is traditionally one of the primary leading indicators of recession. But that's slacked off a little bit as well, as the Federal Reserve took action to cut rates that straightened or turned the yield curve back into an upward sloping pattern, where low rates or short rates were lower than the long rates, and that calmed investors and markets as well. And so we did see a little bit of a pulling off. But now, as this goes forward, we can probably expect these risks or these fears to accelerate a little bit more as well. The yield curve and the interest rates are now getting a little bit worse again. And the reason that most analysts are pointing to would be the coronavirus and concerns about China. And that coronavirus is a legitimate risk, and not so much in a purely accounting sense. If you're trying to add up how big the affected people and companies are as a size of the economy, that doesn't really, you can't really make an amount to much. At least what we can measure. Where the numbers can be big tends to be in supply chains, within industries, which are very, very difficult for us to see. But it's not so much an accounting problem. The problem is that recessions are really a psychological phenomenon at heart. It's really this coordinated pessimism when everyone pulls back at once because of fears of or uncertainty in terms of the outcome. And a lot of times, what's needed is a shock or a coordinating event to create this pessimism all at once. And that's what, as a forecaster, is most concerning about the coronavirus, is insofar as it could serve as this shock or coordinating event. Our last recession, we had the Lehman moment when, although Lehman was a huge financial service firm, in terms of the overall financial service industry, just a drop in the bucket from an accounting sense. But nevertheless, you know, it certainly did help, you know, to kickstart the last recession. You know, that one, of course, was, you know, financial contagion was what went on, you know, following the Lehman moment. This one is, you know, more of an actual epidemiological contagion, but nevertheless, you know, has a lot in common insofar as it, the potential to be wide-ranging across, you know, countries and regions of the globe, and, of course, the uncertainty. You know, at that point, we didn't know where all this bad debt was, and we didn't know who was going to be next in terms of which financial service firms and which investors were going to be exposed. And here we're in the same sort of position where we're not exactly sure which supply chains and which industries are most at risk, and we don't know how, you know, far spread or where this, you know, where this will get us to. So with that, I will pass it along to Joshua, who will tell us what we do know about the potential exposure.
For the record, Josh Lehner, economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. And that's right, right? If we think that maybe this potential pandemic will not be a coordinating event for a global recession, and most forecasters do not believe it will be that as of today, given the information we know, what are some of these primary channels in which we'll see the impact of a shutdown in China? Because that's effectively what we're talking about, right? We're talking about factories being furloughed or shut down, large swaths of the population being quarantined and kept from work. So, you know, in China is the second largest economy in the world. It accounts for 16% of global GDP. It's a commerce hub. Lots of raw materials flowing in, lots of intermediate goods and finished goods flowing out to consumers and other economies around the world. And so to the extent that this is shut down for an extended period of time, it's really going to bog down global supply chains. So you can't get products and goods around the world. And the longer it goes on, the larger the potential cost would mount. It's quite disruptive to China. It's quite disruptive to Asia already. As of now, provided some of these restrictions are lifted in the coming weeks as expected, then it's somewhat of a rounding error to the U.S. economy. So this is not a major derailment to the U.S. expansion as of today. Here in Oregon, right, we're concerned because a couple of our A lot of our firms have operations in China, customers in China. China's our number one market for export, our destination market for Oregon exports. 20-30% of all exports go to China. So the longer it lasts, the larger the potential impact. A couple other channels which we might see impacts would be tourism. Reduced Chinese tourism given global restrictions in place. Piecing together some information from Travel Oregon reports, it looks like we see about 70,000 Chinese tourists to Oregon a year. They spend $250 to $300 million. That's about 2% of the travel industry in Oregon overall, right? Represents from China. So there's a potential fallout there, at least in the near term, with lower international tourism. And then the other one is financial markets, as kind of Mark was talking about. A stronger U.S. dollar hurts growth, wider credit risk spreads in financial markets, hurts lending activity and business investment decisions and things like that. So that's sort of some financial market fallout from the unknown of the potential of a new virus. And again, this is all new stuff and it's a developing situation. And some of these economic costs are much smaller than the human or the social costs associated with these sort of events as well. If we look at our outlook and moving forward, we really have a stable economic forecast here. Maybe, and it's a little bit stronger in the out years. In the near term, it's stable, and the out years a little bit stronger. Here we're showing year-over-year job growth between Oregon and the U.S. You'll notice, historically, Oregon typically outperforms the typical state in job growth. Our job gains are, you know, 0.5%, 1%, sometimes 2% faster than the typical state. In the last couple of years, that's no longer the case. Our employment growth has slowed for two primary reasons. The economy is stronger. There's a lot less unemployed Oregonians kind of waiting around looking for a job. So it's harder to grow. But then also our labor force flows are a little bit smaller coming in. The available supply of labor is growing more slowly for demographic reasons as baby boomers retire and due to slower migration. If we look over the future, you see our forecast still expects Oregon to outperform the U.S. And that's mostly due to the fact we have a, you know, more modern mix of manufacturing industries, a better industrial structure, faster productivity gains. But predominantly it's due to stronger population growth that's assumed. But that is potentially an issue to watch as well.
Yeah, absolutely, which is, you know, the population growth being our primary comparative advantage, as Josh mentioned, and there are, we have concerns now that we're really seeing this drop off, in particular with the most recent numbers that have come out.
Yeah. Yes, Senator, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I just want to ask you a question while you're on labor. The last two forecast labor hours have flattened, gone down and flattened. Where are we at with that? I don't want to jump ahead, but
go ahead. Chair Nathanson, Senator Finley, those have continued to stabilize and a little bit of a rebound in the last few months when it comes to those manufacturing hours work, but they're still down certainly over the last year and lower than they were in years past. So it's still a weak point. Manufacturing continues to be weak, but I guess the optimistic way to say it would be that the manufacturing industry is finding its footing, right, is no longer continuing to deteriorate, but it's starting to stabilize both nationally and locally.
Thank you. Thank you, Manager.
That's right. And across, you know, economic indicators and the like, really that's where we do see the most softness is in production of goods and manufacturing. But what's still pulling the weight is the American consumer continues to spend, and we expect that to persist as long as people still feel comfortable in their job situation, that they still feel like they have security, and going forward, they'll continue to spend money. But of course, you know, that again is a psychological phenomenon, so keep our fingers crossed.
There's another question on the same point.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. You just mentioned population growth, and I just wanted to understand how that is impacting this. So that's contributing to the decline. How?
Oregon's primary comparative advantage is population growth insofar as whenever we have jobs available, people want to come here, and they'll come here at a discount. So it's not just about people and their direct, they move here and they have, you know, demand for housing and consumer goods and like. That's important, but it's not the main factor. The main factor is on the supply side, where our employers can have their pick of the litter, so to speak. And, you know, we don't have MIT or Stanford University here in Oregon, but we can get an engineer from there at a discount relative to our competitors, and that's a huge advantage. So as we've gone through this cycle, we've seen, you know, in a 10-year cycle, we've exhausted all the surplus labor we had. In the beginning, we had an army of unemployed workers. Those have all been drawn back in. And so now our growth is really constrained by how fast our labor force is expanding. And that's really tied to migration, which makes it particularly scary that the most recent estimates of migration are off in Oregon. And this could be technical, this could be a one-time thing, but nevertheless is a primary risk to the regional forecast right now. Here we see population growth in Oregon, which now is predominantly migration, as we've seen the natural rate of population growth shrink drastically. You know, the number of births, less the number of deaths, given the demographics. So it's migration, which has, again, always been a good thing for Oregon. And our forecast called for, you know, around 50,000 migrants, net migrants a year, in keeping with what we've seen in recent years, and in particular in keeping with our leading indicators of population growth, like school enrollments and the surrendered driver's license at the DMV. When you move from California and come to Oregon, you need to get an Oregon driver's license. You turn that in, and we track that as well. And so we expected, you know, a little bit of a fall off, but still very high rates of growth. But now we've seen the mid-year population estimates for 2019 came out. First PSU, which is a good 10,000 migrants or population gains lower than our expectations. And then the census is another 5,000 lower than that, which are significant numbers in terms of the outlook. Again, if we're constrained by labor force growth, that's a big deal. Half of these folks are working age, and then, you know, 3/4 of the working age population participate in the labor force. So we're looking at 6,000 to 9,000 decline in annual labor force growth. So that cuts, you know, our job growth estimates potentially by a quarter or a third. So a real significant event if this, you know, if this does persist and is a permanent phenomenon. our advisors suggest that we haven't really built this fully into the economic and revenue forecast yet, this drop off. Our advisors suggest we not do that until we see the census 2020 numbers come out, when they benchmark all of these annual population estimates. And sometimes, you know, there are some significant revisions, so it might make sense until we get the real number, or the more comprehensive number, here in another year before we really act on this initial signals. But nevertheless, it's a significant risk to the outlook. But luckily,
we have two committee members who have some questions for you. Representative Reschke first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. McMullen, you said so population is declining. I'm going to ask you a chicken egg question. And does population growth drive the job growth, or does job growth drive the population growth? Which one is the driver in this situation?
Yeah, Representative Reschke, Chair Nathanson, you're right. It's a chicken and egg. There's interplay between both, but it primarily looks like job growth drives the population growth more than the other way around. There are some feedback, like I say, population growth does create a demand for consumer services and housing and stuff like that, so there, it is positive for growth, but it really appears in terms of the timing of it that it's the jobs really kickstart the population rather than the other way around.
So then a quick follow-up. Thank you. So does that mean that our job growth is slowing in Oregon, and this is just what we're seeing because of that?
That is a possibility. There are other theories out there. If this is true, of course, the affordability of housing is another thing that folks are throwing around. And one of the reasons people have moved here in the past is because Oregon has had relatively affordable housing, and that's still the case vis-a-vis California and the places where we mostly draw migrants. But nevertheless, given the inflation in housing costs over the last several years, it presents another risk in addition to the employment situation.
Thank you.
And before Representative Marsh asked the question, I failed to remind people that if you had been wondering where the presentation is or information about the forecast is, if you hadn't refreshed your screen yet, if you had a computer window open, if you refresh the screen, information that was previously not available is now public. So give it another try. Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to clarify, do we have the demographic breakdown of that decreased census? Do we know who's not coming? Is it the same groups that we would traditionally expect? Is it proportional? Is it a loss of specific populations?
We got the most recently we got the new IRS migration data, which is useful in terms of being able to take one filer and say, okay, you filed in Kentucky last year and now you're filing in Oregon this year. And so that was just released for the 2018, not 2019, and at least at that point the patterns of migration in Oregon were relatively the same. Mm-hmm. Where we draw from virtually every state in the union with a huge amount from California, but then lose population to Washington up north, which has happened since the beginning of time, and now more recently in the last 5 to 10 years, we also have been net losers in terms of migrants to Idaho as well. But other than that, they come from about everywhere, and a pretty good range of income as well.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, and if you look at the age breakdown of the mm-hmm. census data, you know, there's a lot of year-to-year fluctuation, so it's really hard to say whether the 2018 migration data, which is the last year we have detailed data on at the census level, is drastically different. I mean, they're up and down relative to 2017, but whether that's just noise in the sample or not, it's hard to say at this point in time. But again, once we get that anchoring 2020 number, that's going to give us a lot more clarity on how Oregon's population has grown.
Right. Thank you.
Do you have any information or data that helps us understand the degree to which our in-state college and university students stay in Oregon or leave after they've completed achieving a certificate or a degree?
Yeah, there is some chair Nathanson, and we can follow up with some more detail on that, probably even the next meeting. That sounds like a good topic. But in general, the assumptions at least made by PSU are that a lot of the folks leave. And in fact, for the Eugene metropolitan area, PSU shows very little population gains among your younger adults, because there's the implicit assumption that when you graduate U of O, you're going to leave Eugene. Now, you know, our demographer doesn't feel that way, thinks that there will, you know, there are a share of graduates that stay. And I think that that's probably a more appropriate assumption, but we can try to track down the exact better rate of that.
Right. And we will. We'll update some of the work. A couple years ago, looked at the Eugene-specific region and the out-migration of young college graduates, and the majority of them went to Portland, right? So they stayed within the state, but they moved to the big economic hub of the state sort of thing. So they weren't necessarily leaving Oregon, but we can certainly update some of that previous work.
Sometimes people leave and then come back. That's even harder to figure out. But it reminds me of conversations, whether it's earlier I was very interested in healthcare occupations. We have such a shortage, but every state is facing a shortage in certain areas, such as primary care professionals. But it is, again, thinking about chicken and egg with lack of opportunity, you leave. But if you leave, then we don't have the people who are helping with the entrepreneurial activity to create opportunity for others. It's an interesting conundrum. Thank you.
So moving on, luckily, population growth is not our only comparative advantage. We also have comparative advantage in productivity gains as well.
That's right. We've typically thought of the population growth as being the primary driver of Oregon's stronger long-run growth. But now that we're in this mature business cycle, this mature expansion, we're in the 11th year, we've never been here, it's at least potentially possible that these classic drivers of the economy, productivity gains and the labor force growth, are shifting. And we continue to see Oregon outpace the typical state when it comes to GDP, productivity growth, and income growth. And so it's possible that we will rely upon these more moving forward, where those migration flows are slower and our employment growth is slower in matching the U.S., but our productivity gains will not. And this chart, it's complicated, but what we're trying to show is Oregon income, household income, relative to the U.S. So when you're above zero, Oregonians have higher income. When you're below zero, you have lower income than the U.S. Across the entire distribution. So at the 5th percentile, the 10th percentile, all the way up to the 95th percentile, and then a couple different years, right? The dark blue at the top is 2018. You know, for the bottom 70%, so the vast majority of Oregon households have higher incomes than their U.S. counterparts, for the first time really since the mills started closing. In the 1980s, and then we just kind of left the 2014 line on there before, which we showed the committee years ago, to show that this growth we've seen in the last handful of years, which is really tied to underlying labor market gains and increases in employment, rising wages, and the like, is really across the board. It's among our low-income households, and it's also we're seeing some solid gains at our high-income households, although those in the top, you know, 1%, top 10% of Oregonian income are still below their national counterparts. We're not a financial hub. We don't have, investment houses and movie stars and things like that. But there's, obviously they're doing well, but maybe not quite as well as some of those national figures. But again, the broad-based gains across the entire spectrum. And again, this is the first time we've seen higher median household income for households in the middle since at least the 1960 census, right? So it's been over 50 years since we've seen something like this. And so this is, in theory, at least in part driven by increased productivity gains, allowing firms to pay higher wages to employees. That could be one of the components here. But overall, this has been a good story.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I was curious, do you have that information by county within Oregon, please? Income distribution? Not right now, but I mean, do you have it available?
Chair Nathanson, Senator Taylor, we can get it by maybe a dozen or so geographic regions of the state. There's a certain, you have to have 100,000 population size to get detailed census data to create this. Mm-hmm. So for Representative Owens and Senator Finley's district, it's quite large. It'd be entire, mostly the east side of the state. But for the west side of the state, we can get not quite county, but pretty close.
Okay, I'd follow up. Thank you, Chair Nathan. I was just, the reason I'm asking is, you know, we're in past reports and in other committees, we're always hearing about how in the metropolitan areas on a whole, Oregonians' household income is increasing. However, it's not increasing as much in other areas of the state. And I was just curious if you had that information, but I guess we have versions of it at other places. Thank you.
Representative Smith. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the explanation on the income percentile for those 75 to 95 or 75 to 100%. Couldn't one add to that argument by stating that those in the higher income percentile have the methods and means to control their income distribution or their wealth distribution, and they find Texas and other non-income tax states as a place to call home, even though they perhaps may have second homes in Oregon?
Chair Nathan, yeah, I think that's a fair theory to make. Usually what I point out, I think, is the primary driver is industry mix and traditional industry mix. In particular, we're not a big financial center. And a lot of these highest incomes in the country are in these big financial centers, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, which really move the needle. And they have all that old money there. And, you know, we have wealthy individuals here, but nothing like, you know, those big old traditional centers.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So in terms of the revenue forecast and update, we'll start by airing our dirty laundry. This is the current biennium general fund and lottery combined forecast for available resources as it's evolved over each quarter that we come in front of you here. And so these are each quarter for the past four plus years. And where our estimates for 2019-2021 have landed. And as you see here, for the last two at least, we have had a consistent pattern of every time we come in front of you, here's so more money, more money, more money, with the biggest jump being right after that big April surprise this year when we got such a tremendous amount of money during the personal income tax filing season. The first time this was, you know, this forecast was actually used for policy purposes would have been December 2018, would have been when it was incorporated into the governor's recommended budget, and then May of 2019 would have been when it would put into the close of session budget for budgeting purposes. We've had this around. As long as I've been here, we call this the Dennis Richardson chart. Dennis Richardson was the co-chair of Ways and Means when I first started. And in about my first week or two, he asked for a meeting to talk about the revenue forecast. And I had no idea what I was walking into at the time. But he had this picture, although it was reversed at that point, where it was falling sharply quarter after quarter after quarter after quarter. And he aggressively asked me if I was willing to bet the farm that it wouldn't fall, you know, what going forward again. And that's of course hard to do, bet the farm, but we're in the same sort of issue, right? We have the opposite issue right now in terms of why are we continually get more and more than we expect. And it's really because of as we're seeing, you know, as we expected, the job growth is slowing down, output growth in Oregon is slowing down, the underlying economy is kind of ratcheting down in terms of growth, but that same can't be said for our primary tax instruments. Oregon's tax revenues continue to outstrip, you know, the underlying gains we're seeing in terms of labor markets and incomes and the like. And this is across a wide range of our instruments, you know, personal income taxes, corporate income taxes, lottery revenues, liquor revenues, marijuana, the like, pretty much everything, estate taxes, which we'll talk about a little bit later. It's really a broad-based gain. And so the puzzle is, you know, to try to figure out how much of this increase is permanent, associated with a broader tax base, and how much is just due to temporary phenomenon, particularly things like timing of payments around the federal tax reforms and the like. So how much of this is going to come off in the months and years ahead? And the longer that this, you know, we see this revenue boom go on, the more likely that a good share of it is permanent, and so we add more to the outlook as a result. And that's the main change that we've seen this time in the forecast is we've increased the personal income tax outlook throughout the forecast horizon in keeping with some of these gains, and in particular in keeping with how strong our personal income tax withholdings have been. So traditionally what they take out of your paycheck from week to week, how is that growing? And in the past, it's always been really in lockstep with our economic measures of wages in terms of what we see from the labor market data, what we see from the commerce income data, and also what we see from our own tax return data, which is unfortunately not as timely, but once people file their taxes, they write down what they had on their W-2, and that has traditionally really moved right in step with what we see in terms of our withholding. There were always exceptions. We would see it diverge for temporarily due to administrative changes to the withholding tables, or if some of our real big employers would pay a lot of bonuses in a year, those bonus payments would have the withholdings diverge from growth in underlying wages, but never for an extended period of time like we're seeing here. And that's what this chart tries to show, that really ever since 2015 we've seen that red bar, which is these tax payments and withholdings grow really significantly faster than both the labor force, labor department's estimates, which are the BEA wages, Bureau of Economic Analysis of the Commerce, you could do that for the QCEW, or the labor wages look exactly the same as well in recent years. And for the darker blue, which is what we see on tax returns, which we'll finally get a picture of here in 2019 shortly. So while the refund season has just begun, we're really not seeing big numbers come in yet in terms of the refunds, and in terms of people that are actually pay taxes, we don't see those returns or that money until closer to April, and a lot of times those returns in the extension filing season in the fall. But we'll have a better idea next time we come in front of you in terms of what the reported wages are on the tax returns, but expect them to be very much like the economic measures of wages. So we've been obsessing a little bit about what's going on here, and it's very difficult to get the full picture of why, but one element of it that pretty convincingly is higher amounts of retirement income or taxable retirement income, particularly pensions and IRA accounts. When people take a withdrawal out of their IRA, they often have withholdings, and pensions often have withholding as well. And so, although we don't have, unfortunately, in terms of actual withholdings out of the 1099-R retirement data, we don't have a time series. We can take a look at, the last year or two, but don't get a real picture of how this has evolved over time. But in terms of the income, or as reported on the tax returns, we do. And given the demographics, we expect these sort of reported income to these types to increase drastically. Here you see the population of individuals in Oregon 75 years or older is just about to really ramp up as we go forward, and so too do we expect these retirement income sources to increase. Here we have federally taxable Social Security, which isn't taxable in Oregon, but is part of the pie, and then the IRAs and pensions. Today we have about the amount of pensions is a little bit more than the IRAs and Social Securities put together. That share will shrink going forward as traditional pensions have become less and less popular among employers. They've gone to defined contribution plans rather than defined benefit plans and the like, and so that will shift in terms of the composition, but in terms of the size, it's going to take a bigger and bigger chunk of the width of the pie, which again means good things for withholding and has caused us to increase our withholding outlook going forward. On the negative side, these taxpayers don't pay as typically, you know, as high average rates or effective tax rates as some of our other higher earners. And so this will, you know, lower the effective tax rate going forward as this becomes a bigger and bigger part of the Oregon personal income tax base. So in addition to income taxes, there was one other really big upward revision in our revenue forecast, and that would be estate taxes.
Estate taxes is something, if we're going to be honest about it, is something we've struggled with in recent years forecasting. We have kind of, there's kind of four main things going on, right? We have the aging population, so therefore you would expect we're going to see you know, more and more of our friends and neighbors pass away every year. We have rising asset markets, so the valuations of people's financial situation continue to increase. We have tax planning in particular, which helps limit some of the estate tax exposure. A lot of our financial advisors and our accountants and the like say it's really easy to manage around this. And so that there should be some sort of lid on these revenue gains because you can gift it away years in advance or set up trusts or things like that. So that kind of pushes back against those underlying demographic and asset prices. And then we obviously have the irregular nature of which the timing of when some of our high net worth households do transition from this life to more life. And so we have all these complicating factors here, but the long story short is that estate tax revenues in Oregon continue to increase significantly. Our friends over at the Department of Revenue, as they're processing payments, you know, in recent weeks, they notice extremely large estate tax payments among a handful of taxpayers. It's not necessarily in the financial statements yet, but it will hit it. They flagged it and let us know, and so we have incorporated that into this most recent forecast. Estate taxes for this biennium, relative to 3 months ago, are raised $87 million, in large part because we're going to more than double the previous record for monthly collections that we set back a few years ago, which itself was more than double the previous record from, you know, 5-10 years ago. And so these collections continue to increase. We have raised the long-term outlook to a certain degree. But there's a lot of upside risk associated with this. There's some preliminary research by our friends at the Department of Revenue, again, that shows that the volume of the valuation of these estates that's being transitioned or bequeathed to spouses is, you know, a third to half the size of the actual collections we're seeing, right? If you bequeath it to a spouse, it's not taxed at that point in time, but maybe when the spouse passes away at some point in the future, then it may be subject to that tax. But of course, that provides other opportunities for estate tax planning or getting remarried or whatever the case may be. There's a whole lot of possibilities at that point in time. But it's, again, it's really being driven by a handful of estates, you know, a few hundred, not just one or two, a few hundred overall, that their asset values and their net wealth is continuing to increase very significantly in recent years. And we're expecting some of this to persist indefinitely. But again, it's irregular, right? We don't know exactly when the timing of some of these life events will occur, let alone when the tax payments will show up in the door at Department of Revenue. But something we continue to increase. These payments are significantly above our forecast in recent years and recent biennium.
Senator Finley.
Madam Chair, so this issue intrigues me somewhat for a variety of reasons, but so did I understand you to say that we're on forecast to have $87 million in additional revenue in estate taxes than forecast, and we had forecast, it appears, at around $185 or $190 million. Is that, am I reading the chart correctly? Do you have the ability to break that down from standard estates to the mega estates? I mean, I've heard a lot of conversations with tax planners and folks at all that those standard estates, a lot of those folks are leaving the state in advance to execute their estate stuff because of the estate tax limitation that we have. Can you break that down at all?
Chair Nathanson, Senator Finley, we can, but with a lag. Department of Revenue has updated data through 2017, right? We're not, with some of these largest estates we've seen, particularly in the last month, we don't have the actual return in the door yet. We have the payment process, but we don't have the return itself, let alone process the return and able to analyze it in depth. But to your point, one of the concerns our advisors raise as well is that Oregon's relatively low $1 million threshold for the estate tax. Potentially with a hot housing market, we would ensnare more Oregonians in the estate tax just due to the value of homes breaching $1 million. While that may be true, the share of estate taxpayers that are kind of in that $1 or $2 million estate valuation range is pretty steady, right? That isn't really increasing so much. Those that have $2 or $3 or $4 million estates isn't really increasing that much. It's really the $5 million and above, the $10 million and above estates where the tax revenue itself is coming from. And again, it's not so much that there's a lot more folks in this type of bracket, it's that the value of their estates is continuing to increase quite quickly.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. So do you have data showing, do you have any way of knowing if people are leaving the state? And then I don't know, so I mean, right before they pass, so that, I mean, is there any way for us to know that? One's one question. The second question I have is, what is the, we have the, ours is at the $1 million threshold. What is the national average, or we must know what the 50 states are at? I'm just trying to see, are we extreme one way or the other?
On the threshold? I'm sorry.
Yeah. The threshold.
Chair Nathanson, Senator Taylor, we do have a low threshold. I believe
at least 35
states do not have an estate tax. At least that was one of the potential fallouts of some Bush era changes to the federal code, which then kind of got rid of a lot of states. So there's not very many states that actually have an estate or inheritance tax. And our threshold, we're either the lowest in the nation or certainly one of the lowest in the nation. And so whether that impacts migration, I think it's fair to say that it does to a certain degree. I know the Department of Revenue, our friends over there, have done some, if you get federal returns, right, you can match federal returns and know whether, you know, someone passed away in Washington that was previously an Oregonian or something like that. I'm not sure what the latest data they have on that, but I know, you know, in recent years they have looked at that sort of impact.
The follow-up. So, I mean, obviously, I understand the argument of why it was, you know, set at 1 million. However, I just want to make certain that we didn't set a threshold and then we end up actually being harmed by that, because people are going, if there's going to be a trend going to another state, then that threshold isn't really suiting us very well. I'm just curious about it. That's all.
Yeah, Chair Nathanson, Senator Taylor, again, as Josh mentioned, a lot of our advisors say the estate tax really doesn't make a lot of people move, again, because you can do a lot of management around it, create family trust and the like, and people don't want to leave their physical estates. If it's a nice house and a ranch and you've lived there for your, you know, 20, 30 years, you're not ready to go to Vancouver, you know, overnight. So that's an issue. But that said, you know, there are certainly people that move. And in particular, not the estate tax, but where there is a bigger concern here is we're getting the baby boom population cohort hitting their retirement years would be folks who have owned their own business and have a lot of capital gains in terms of their business valuations. And in those cases, I think there's a stronger argument that our tax system might be driving people out.
Interesting. Thank you.
Just one more thing to point out along the migration aspect would be the other thing our tax advisors tell us or advise us on is it's really that federal threshold that matters. Mm-hmm. Getting below that roughly $11 million at the federal, people are very comfortable gifting away or trusting away their estates to get below the federal impact, because that's a much larger tax impact. But somewhere in that $1 million Oregon range to the federal $11 million range, roughly speaking, you know, they're comfortable being in there. So there is a state impact, but not a federal impact when it comes to taxes as a life events occur. Oh, thank you. Now, one side effect, one fallout of this increase in estate taxes is, given the passage of Senate Bill 1566 a couple years ago now, where it sets, you know, it basically sets a 10-year trend on estate tax collections, and if estate tax collections come in above that 10-year trend, then that excess revenue above the trend is transferred to the PERS UAL fund, right? And given the recent collection we've seen in the last couple of weeks and our changes to the forecast, we are now in that range where about $17.6 million of estate tax collections are expected to be transferred to the PERS UAL after the closure of the biennium. Once we get to the end of 1921, we'll finalize the math and see if we did hit that threshold. There's one complicating factor with the language in the law that says notwithstanding the kicker, or you know, if there is a kicker, then we won't make the transfer to the PERS account. And right now we're not projecting a kicker, so we're in that sweet spot, probably not the right word to say, but we're in that range where state tax collections are above trend, but we're not projecting a kicker, so there will be a transfer made. But if there is a kicker, then that transfer would not occur unless the language around the legislation is changed moving forward. And to sum all of this up, this discussion we've had just in our last few minutes, we have raised the general fund forecast. Available resources are up that $174 million you see in yellow at the bottom. Kind of looking at that middle column, this is the change of the current forecast relative to 3 months ago when we last met. You know, half of that or the majority of that is coming from the personal income tax collections, which is largely that withholding issue that Mark was talking about. Withholdings continue to be a lot stronger than the underlying economy. We've bumped up that forecast. And then the other revenues are up quite a bit. The majority of that is the estate taxes we just discussed, $87 million. Then there was also interest earnings are strong, and there was a one-time restitution payment from a solar firm related to inappropriate Betsy credits or accounts and things like that finally made its way all the way through the legal process, and the money is in the door, and that accounts for about $13 million of that change relative to 3 months ago. And then finally, we have the slide we've been ending on for the last couple of years is reserve situation continues to improve, right? The economy is doing well after a decade-long expansion. The reserve funds are starting to amount to a couple $1 billion at the end of the biennium. We're now starting to think about hitting some of the statutory caps to these in a couple of years. Now we're still a couple years away out, and a lot can change in the next 24 months regarding the economy and potential recessions or the like. But things like the Education Stability Fund are nearing their 5% statutory cap. It'll be a couple years beyond that before the Rainy Day Fund thinks about hitting its 7.5% cap. But again, these reserves have started to accumulate. They should help on the revenue side if we have a medium-sized recession in the coming years. But they aren't large enough to, you know, alleviate the revenue declines plus the increased spending from additional caseloads and Oregonians in need. But this is something that should help stabilize the budget, unlike past recessions, given the size of these reserve funds.
Representative Kenny Geyer, is your question still relevant at this time, or do you want to ask it later?
I was wondering about 1566, whether I can ask it later, but whether that 10% only had to do with excess expectation in estate taxes or other corporate, you know, all the windfall things that we used to talk about that are so hard to plan for. If that's appropriate now, great. Otherwise, I can.
Yeah,
it's one of those things as a new revenue committee member, not having dug into that when it was passed a couple years ago.
Let's spend 1 or 2 minutes on that and then go to Senator Taylor.
Okay. All right, Representative Kenny Geyer, sorry, Chair Nathanson. Senate Bill 1566 took two of these very volatile revenue streams and did the same sort of thing with them. In addition to estate taxes, we're doing the same thing with capital gains tax.
That's what I thought. Thank
you. We're taking the 10-year trend and shaving off any excess. Oh, and also another one-timer was in there as well, which was repatriation of foreign earnings that was associated with the federal tax law change. And that one maybe bears mentioning because it was one of the significant changes we made to the forecast this time. Those repatriation dollars here at the end of this biennium, the Department of Revenue is going to sit down and try to estimate how much that was and then make a deposit. And so originally, we expected that to be, I believe, in the range of $145 million were the original legislative revenue office estimates. Some subsequent work by the Department of Revenue suggested those would be smaller, so we scaled those down by about a third. And now we've had even fresher work from our friends at the Department of Revenue that say, it looks like it may be even larger than the 145, but probably 145 roughly is a good number. So we've gone back to that, and that you'll see that in this in slide 13 in terms of the corporate income tax transfer to rainy day fund and PERS UAL line. That $45 million decrease in resources, increase in that transfer is associated mostly with that repatriation piece.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Just a technical question regarding when you were talking about the reserve funds and when you hit the cap, is there any current language in statute directing where money would need to go, or is that just go back to the general fund?
Chair Nathanson, Senator Taylor, regards to the Education Stability Fund, right now, the way the money flows is 18% of lottery earnings go to the Education Stability Fund. Once you hit that cap, that switches from 18% to 15%, and that goes to the capital matching account. But the extra, that difference of 3 percentage points is retained within the lottery fund and will be available for the legislature to decide how to share it. On the rainy day fund itself, I believe those are just retained, but I don't know offhand the specifics yet.
Thank you.
So that's it for our prepared comments.
I wish you had some fabulous closing remark. I often write down some clever quote at the end.
They only show the pictures. So I mean, that's good. That's a good close.
That's good. Representative Smith.
First of all, gentlemen, great job. I really appreciate the professionalism that you bring to the state. Madam Chair, I have my Ways and Means hat on, and right now, and I just think it's so important that these joint committees have an open and frank conversation with the Ways and Means folks to help them understand the information we're receiving and what the future most likely will hold for the state of Oregon. I think our co-chairs in Ways and Means have done an outstanding job preparing for the future. I genuinely mean that. But I think we all have to understand that the sunshine we're seeing today may get a little cloudy in the very near future. And as someone who's been through multiple special sessions trying to rebalance budgets, I think it's really important for us to have a little bit of fiscal restraint and continue to save a dollar or two in preparation for that. And the reason I raise that issue is I think you as chair and our Senate Finance Chair really need to have that conversation with them to make sure that we're prepared for 2, 3, 4 years from now, because the time is coming when the fund that we've been having is going to tighten up. So I just want to get that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, sort of.
That's a bear of fun news.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you for the presentation. There is no other business before us today. I'm closing the informational meeting on the revenue forecast, and we are adjourned.